A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
It's much more complex than just controlling, you know, the way you pay attention. And there's layers and layers of ADHD, not just because it's different because of the hyperactivity. It's because of the late diagnosis, because then you have layers and layers of shame and layers of not understanding your experience and filling in the blanks in all sorts of distorted ways.
Hello and welcome to the Women and ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Katie Weber. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 45, and it completely turned my world upside down. I've been looking back at so much of my life, school, jobs, my relationships, all of it with this new lens, and it has been nothing short of overwhelming. I quickly discovered I was not the only woman to have this experience, and now I interview other women who, like me, discovered in adulthood they have ADHD and are finally feeling like they understand who they are and how to best lean into their strengths, both professionally and personally. Today is a big day. It marks exactly 1 year since I released my first interviews. And what an incredible year this has been. In the last year, I have interviewed women from all over the US and Canada, women in the UK, Greece, Australia, New Zealand, and these episodes have been listened to in 100 countries around the world. I mean, when I first started to reach out to women, never did I ever think these interviews and conversations would resonate with so many of you. And yet the podcast has received 200,000 downloads in its first year. So thank you from the bottom of my heart to all of you who have reached out to me over this past year to tell me how much these interviews have meant to you. And thank you to all of you who have left reviews or shared this podcast. I've heard from therapists who have shared this podcast with their patients. I've heard from patients who have shared this podcast with their therapists. And I have heard from so many of you who are sharing these episodes with family and friends to help put a face to ADHD in women. It has been so moving to play this small role in changing the way ADHD is understood and helping other women to see they are not alone and to realize that they're not broken or lazy or inadequate. In fact, quite the opposite. We are extraordinary women and mothers and partners. All of us are having an incredible impact on the lives of the people around us. And I hope you are able to see this in yourself. Now, if you had asked me when I first started this podcast who my dream guest would be, I would have said today's guest. She is the godmother of ADHD, psychotherapist, author, and researcher Sari Solden. When Sari Solden wrote Women and Attention Deficit Disorder back in the mid-90s, she was the first researcher to look at how this neurodiversity appears differently in women than in men and why that is. And now, 30 years later, she continues to counsel adults with ADHD and specializes in the unique ways in which ADHD presents in women. In addition to her groundbreaking research and her books on ADHD, she also serves on the professional advisory board of ADDA, the Attention Deficit Disorder Association, and was the recipient of their award for outstanding service by a helping professional. Her books include Women with ADD, Journeys Through Adulthood, and the workbook A Radical Guide for Women with ADHD, which, in my opinion, should be required reading for all late diagnosis women. It was such an absolute pleasure and honor to chat with Sari, and we talk all about the connections she made 30 years ago when it comes to what ADHD looks like in women, why ADHD is overlooked in girls, and why women tend to get diagnosed much later in life. We discuss traits that are unique to women, as well as the current trendiness of an ADHD diagnosis, and Sari reveals how she might rename ADHD if she could. Without further ado, I cannot think of a better way to celebrate 1 year of this podcast than offering this conversation with Sari. Enjoy. So this is such a treat to be able to interview you because, like I said, your book was the first book I read after I was diagnosed. And I listened to it, and then I re-listened to it again recently in preparation for this interview with this like year of behind me. And it was really interesting to sort of have that different perspective of, you know, when I first read it, it was just like, I was going through that feeling of like, you know, like the book says, you mean I'm not crazy and I'm not lazy and I'm not stupid. And then this is not just me. Like there's so much of, I think what is so profound about your book, yeah. Is that, you know, there is a lot of shame in these private experiences that you know, self-care and hygiene and sort of a lot of these things that, I was realizing for the first time, was a shared experience among women with ADHD. And now a year later, I'm like, yeah, but I still have ADHD. Right. So now it's like, just meaning that like, there's a lot of things that are still a struggle, you know, like even with the diagnosis behind you, like you still are living with this and sort of, what does that mean?
That's a really important point to explore, because our last book, and if you read Radical Guide for Women, you know, I mean, that is the point of it, is that you have to, this is a chronic condition, you know, your brain and all the stuff you're going to do for it, your medication, all that, strategies, tips, tools, whatever, that's your brain. That's not you. And you have to sort of untangle those two things and come to terms with it. This is chronic. This is nothing. And you don't want to approach it like you want to get over it, because that's who you are. And you just want to get help for your brain difficulties and accept them because they're chronic. And then the rest of it is getting on with your life like you are, and, you know, and accepting and valuing yourself. So that is an important, so, you know, you sometimes it's framed like, okay, take this medication or get a diagnosis and you'll get over this. And that's not true, you know, and you don't want to get fixed, you know.
It's right. Like, absolutely.
Only dogs and furniture get fixed, right?
Yes. And I sort of feel like there is so much literature out there that comes, you know, that it revolves around that idea of like, we'll cure it, you know, mm-hmm. and get, you know, master your ADHD. And a lot of that can be really problematic.
It is. That is the most problematic. So that's why we wrote that other book, which is really helping a lot of women right now. Cause, you know, I wrote the first book in 95, originally it was published. And so then this is years later, the Radical Guide is to disavow women of that, of what you just said, you know,
right?
Like, what is the goal? Yeah. The goal is not to get over who you are. And, you know, so
I did want to ask you, because I know you wrote your first book almost 30 years ago,
well,
which blows me away.
Revised edition. Yeah. Revised edition was in 2005. I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which is what I'm assuming I listened to, because I listened to you read the audiobook. So that would have been the revised edition.
Oh, well, that was even much later. That was when I put out the audio book. So yeah.
What I do like, you know, what I have been asking throughout my interviews with women, and even though I know you're sort of on as an expert, I am curious about your personal experience with your diagnosis. Like, how old were you and what was happening in your life that led you to sort of make these connections when practically nobody was making these connections? I mean, when we say you were a pioneer in women in ADHD, you're really the first one off the boat.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like. No, well, that's a really interesting question, because, it was in the very early 90s. And yeah, I didn't. Your question was, what made you think you had ADHD? I didn't think about that. There wasn't anything that we were talking about ADHD without hyperactivity at that point. But a lot of great things came together at the same time. But I had been trying to solve this mystery of what I've been struggling with for 40 years, massive disorganization, you know, severe and chronic disorganization, shy, not talking at all, not being able to organize my thoughts, you know, but very smart and hardworking. I just was struggling, you know, and I was very smart. It's called twice exceptional. We call that now, if you've heard that term, it's for people who are twice exceptional. Like they're both ends of the bell curve. Like you're really smart, but you have all these severe challenges, and that's sort of even a harder thing to understand. So it didn't matter how much I was achieving, I would just create more stuff that I couldn't control. And I was very frustrated. And so, but I wound up at a counseling agency and they had a special program for adults with learning disabilities, but it was in a counseling agency. So I always was looking at adults with differences like this in the context of who they are and their self and their relationship and their self-concept. So it was just a lucky place that I ended up I was majoring in minority mental health. And just through that program, I got connected to this other program. And to work at this program, I had to take a test, a learning disability test. And it was the first time I ever had incredible difficulty that was discovered. You know, they gave me some crazy memory test that I imagine other people could pass. And they gave me sort of nonsensical looking Martian looking people and told me their names, and then they'd go back to it. And I couldn't remember a thing. And so it was the first time I saw, wow, I have a severe problem with memory that I've been trying to compensate for all my life. They had no idea about. Then my spare time in between clients, I was surrounded by books about learning disabilities. And I was looking through to find an answer to what the severe and chronic disorganization was all about. And, you know, they discussed it in terms of learning disabilities. At least I saw something identified there. And then a couple books started coming out into my office. One was Driven to Distraction, which was great, but it was the first time we understood that adults had difficulties, even though they might have lost their hyperactivity. But it was still mostly about men and people who used to be hyperactive. And it wasn't until a little bit later that we started talking about how people could have these difficulties without having ever had having hyperactivity. And that's when we started understanding women also had something like this. So I did read that book, Lazy, You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Stupid, or Crazy. And that was the first time I saw adults in general described in a way that made me think, wow, I think that's me. I went to a conference cross country, the first ADHD conference in Ann Arbor. And it was with hundreds of adults for the first time gathered together. And it was the first time I described that in my book, how I saw that adults pass for normal outside and that I was too. And that this is the first time people were just like, women were just like going through their purses and throwing all this stuff around and like interrupting and, you know, writing on their hands when they want to remember something. It was like the first time that everybody was with their tribe. And I understood this was a real thing. And then I did take I had a diagnostic evaluation at that point, you know, a complete neuropsych evaluation. I saw this huge split between my performance, which was really low, and my verbal, which was extremely high, and, you know, showed some of the difficulties with working memory and all these other organizational issues. But basically, you know, I couldn't stay awake. I had sort of like this borderline narcolepsy my whole life. I couldn't stay awake, a very sleepy brain. You know, I couldn't. Women's stuff. I couldn't go shopping. I couldn't go to a grocery store. I was so overwhelmed all the time by all the sensory input. I couldn't filter out, you know, even at that point in the agency, I couldn't imagine people were sitting at the staff table writing notes and talking to each other or like going from one room to another. It was just demands for notes and noise from outside. I was just like, it was a nightmare, you know, for me. I didn't know what was going on. And then I really had a dramatic response to even a small amount of medication at that time. And I started talking, I started speaking up in groups, I started organizing my thoughts, I stayed awake, and it really, just a little bit of medication really helped, you know, change my life. But I had clients at the time, so I started studying them and looking at and tracking the differences between women and men. And that's where, you know, even if they had the same differences, the shame that the women felt about these difficulties, you know, were really so apparent that I started really focusing on it.
Yeah, that's a topic that we discuss a lot in my interviews with women, which is, you know, that the domestic pressures and kind of, you know, how so much of the self-doubt when it comes to like, is this even ADHD or am I just fill in the blank, right? Am I just lazy? Am I just disorganized? I think, you know, like, I feel like a lot of the time I'm like, maybe I'm not, maybe this isn't ADHD. Maybe I'm just a feminist living in this misogynist country. I feel like so many of the specific issues that women are facing come down to our role, you know, our domestic role, our role as wives, our role as mothers, and the expectations, the domestic expectations. Yes.
That's what my book really focused on. And I think that's why it was so popular, besides people identifying themselves and understanding shame. It was about what happens when women feel they can't meet these cultural roles. So it wasn't just this era, it was all the way back. The cultural roles that they've learned to idealize and internalize. And even if intellectually they don't believe it anymore, deep down, they still compare themselves ruthlessly to other women. And these domestic areas that conflict so much with their executive function difficulties, that's where the shame and the hiding and the embarrassment and the disparities in power and their relationships often come, because women still feel, it's like the 1950s in my office, really, no matter who these women are, what they've achieved deep down, when they can't do those domestic things very well, they feel such shame. And like I had someone write to me the other day, I said, you know, who would think that like argument about the pots and pans would, you know, make me think about many ways that I could die, you know, something so poignant, because, you know, still the shame, no matter how successful you are, about like, you didn't do the pots and pans, or why are the dishes in the sink for 3 days, or why didn't you fold the laundry? You know, even if the men are helping with tasks, it's, there's still these deep gender role, the feelings of failure when women can't do these things is the same way or easily. And so it's really hard for people to understand, you as a woman and people you live with.
Right. And I think so many of us come to this diagnosis through recognizing that emotional toil, the emotional toll of being undiagnosed, right? And living this life kind of undiagnosed and not understanding what is actually going on. And so you're beating yourself up. And so, but then at the same time, the DSM has nothing about emotions. And so again, it's like, I feel like we're going in circles in terms of like how hard it must be to educate women as to what this actually is.
Yeah. And it's like you say, it's so much better now, because when I, you know, finally wrote this book, and luckily it was at a time where internet was just beginning to be used, believe it or not. And so that allowed women to start talking to each other and to find their own experiences for themselves, to go to conferences and gather together, because I didn't know. I was really confronted by a huge amount of resistance from the male dominated field. You know, academics were really used to controlling this field and telling parents about their kids, but all of a sudden adults, men and women, were coming into the field, and they were taking over, and they changed the whole field. And women then drove the whole change by going to their doctors and saying, no, this is real, and this is who I am. So women really, by talking to each other, like you said, really changed the face of this. And it's hard to imagine, I know, for you guys, that we didn't talk to each other before that. There wasn't the internet. And so people were even more and more isolated. They had no way to find these things out. And so once that happened, this is just built and built and built, where women are talking to each other all around the world now.
Yeah, it is mind-blowing. I mean, that I think that's the one most common reaction I get for reviews of the podcast, which is like, I finally feel less alone, and I feel like I'm, you know, that there's nothing wrong with me, that I'm listening to other women who are bright and accomplished, who are experiencing the same kind of secret things that I've been going through this my whole life.
I know. I think that's the most therapeutic thing, I think, for women, is to, because when they hear other women who are successful and, you know, really wonderful women, and then they are describing the same struggles that they have, they're forced to sort of shift their own self-image. You know, it's a, you know, a cognitive shift, because they say, well, you know, I can see their strengths, I can see who they are. And so they start to internalize a new self, you know, narrative.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like I've said this before, in the podcast, which is like, I feel like half the quote unquote treatment of ADHD is that self-realization and that shift in narrative and just understanding, and the research that comes with, like, you know, realizing where your behaviors are coming from.
Well, I mean, it's just tricky. And, you know, therapists have a long way to go with helping women with ADHD, because this is, again, there's your brain, there's, you know, and your behaviors and your difficulties. But if they don't come from a non-pathologizing point of view, or see yourself over your symptoms and help you really heal, not cure, heal, which means like see yourself as whole and hold on to both these sides of yourself. You have strengths, you have weaknesses, you have challenges like everybody. And then you also have who you are as a person, your core traits. And it's much more complex than just controlling, you know, the way you pay attention. And there's layers and layers of ADHD, not just because it's different because of the hyperactivity, it's because of the late diagnosis, like you said, and because then you have layers and layers of shame and layers of not understanding your experience and filling in the blanks in all sorts of distorted ways. And that's what therapy for ADHD is really about. You know, you can have coaching and all these other things, but often women who weren't diagnosed till late have many layers of shame and distorted self narratives and hiding and withdrawing, and it just snowballs. So that's why therapy for ADHD for women, you know, has to be more prominent.
Oh, right. Yeah. And I think, again, like once women start to understand what is actually happening, then they're able to kind of move forward and advocate and ask for the accommodations that they need. One of the major accommodations being therapy. But even like, I just notice in like, even in the smallest details in my life, like going to a doctor's office and saying like, you're throwing a lot of information at me. I'm going to need you to write this down. Or can you send me an email or, you know, or.
Exactly. Or, no, I mean, that's like one of the main things we do in therapy, you know, is like this communication skill. Which I think many young women are much better able to do than older women. You know, I find that this new generation of women just value diversity now, aren't so embarrassed by it, are more willing to advocate for themselves. And that's what really changes things. When you can say things like that, that is a really hard thing to say. You feel such shame in the doctor's office or any place where information's coming at you, and to be able to say, to describe. You know, I have difficulty with, you know, remembering this. I need you to write this down, or can you give it to me in the way I need it? That's a huge thing. And that's, you know, really what women struggle with, because they feel like, you know, they're embarrassed, because they feel like revealing those difficulties means something terrible about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and even with my relationship with my husband, I think one of the biggest realizations I had was how I was valuing so much what he brought to the table. I wasn't paying any attention to what I brought to the table. And I think that that's another thing too, that comes with that understanding, which is like being able to realize what gifts you do have, as opposed to focusing. And I don't know if that's like, again, if that's like a dopamine thing where we... You know, I know Halliwell and Rady talk a bit about the devil on the shoulder, and that idea that like we tend to kind of focus on the negative, you know, as a result. But that idea, like how we undermine the things that we do bring to the table because we're focusing so much on what we're not doing.
Right. We're focusing on the negative. It's often in that role that's the most difficult for us when we're at home or with our husbands at executive functions. So we already are very easy, you know, to blame ourselves. Often your spouse isn't even bringing that much negativity. It's often what's coming from you yourself. And you're exactly right. Women don't value these things that they're good at because they're invisible. Maybe they don't value all the invisible, caring, emotional, you know, taking care of people and all the invisible things that they do, or visible, but not so dramatic as the dishes in the sink. So women automatically, you know, compare themselves and lose power in the relationship because they don't, and then they don't see that their partners also struggle most of the time with everybody struggles. So they're only saying, oh, ADHD is like the worst thing in the world. They could be married to a bipolar person or a, you know, alcoholic or anybody who's got their own struggles, but they only see that ADHD is like the worst thing in the world. So women do this to themselves because they didn't have a very self-soothing voice growing up. They didn't have anybody helping them understand, you know, that's not you, that's your challenges, and that's, you know, this is who you are as a person, or no advocacy. And so they, part of therapy is helping them develop, or groups helping them develop that internal valuing voice.
And also understanding that the voice you hear in your head is not always necessarily the truth. I think that was something I learned from dialectical behavioral therapy. And I think a lot of women I have interviewed came to DBT intuitively through, you know, because so many of us were diagnosed with other mood disorders. So, you know, we've so many of us have found value in something like DBT and CBT, as you know, even before we understood what ADHD was.
Oh, yeah. And then those kind of skills, like you asked about radical acceptance. I mean, that's the same kind of idea that originally came from DBT, you know, that idea of, you know, that you, there's pain, and we all have pain about things we can't control or we don't have any say over. We have to face the painful, often frustrating, difficult reality sometimes of living with an unruly brain, but we don't want to add to it. We don't want to add pain. We don't want to add suffering. Suffering comes from, oh, this isn't fair. What's wrong with me? Or why can't I do this? Or I'm such a loser. Or oh, I'm just going to, I got to get over this. I can't let myself do anything else till I get over this. This is terrible. So all the stuff you say to yourself about your ADHD is what moves us from pain to suffering. And that's what, you know, radical acceptance is about, you know, just facing the reality of what you're dealing with and figuring it out what you need to do, and then accepting the difficulties and then not being engulfed by it and not avoiding it or disowning who you are or not running away from or fearing who you are. I mean, living with ADHD is tough enough, but it's not half as tough as as this feeling of disowning who you are and wanting to get rid of who you are and avoiding all of life because you don't think you're entitled to embrace it all because you have clutter or difficulties all around you, or you can't, you know, do domestic things very well. So it takes a lot of work to really accept and hold both sides of all sides of yourself.
Yeah. And I think you and Michelle Frank, that was so well said. And I think you talk about that a lot in your book, the difference between radical acceptance and just, you know, not being open to improvement, or what's the word I'm looking for? Like just feeling resignation almost.
Well, yeah, that acceptance, people are afraid of that word. They think it means resignation or just settling for something less or passivity. And acceptance is like the most active, hardest thing you'll ever do. And it's ongoing and it's constant, whether it's ADHD or other kind of adversity. So acceptance is a very active process. It's not what people think. And you can do whatever you want. You might not be able to do it in the same way that other people do, which might lead you to a very unique kind of experience because you have to work around in a different way. But it certainly doesn't mean that you're going to have to be held back. You're held back by pushing away who you are and hiding who you are. That's what holds you back.
And I think there is a lot of confusion too in terms of how we talk about ADHD, because I often, you know, I get very confused because sometimes I will we'll talk about ADHD as though it's a genetic brain function. And this is something you need to learn to live with. But then there's also the ADHD, which is your behaviors and the traits that, you know, you need to manage and treat and master. And, you know, the way, you know, I think that idea of like getting over some of the problematic behaviors like forgetfulness or you know, distraction. And it can be sort of difficult to think about what exactly are we talking about with ADHD. Is it,
Well, it's not one thing. That's why it's confusing. And I don't like the term ADHD. I don't really use it anymore, you know, because first of all, it changed over the years. So many of us were stuck way back in the ADD thing, you know, and we, you know, the H really threw a lot of us for many years, you know, it just changes all the time. And I prefer, you know, when describing it, to describe the actual difficulty. So I much rather say women with executive function difficulties, which is, you know, management of certain kinds of functions that, that make coordinating logistics difficult. So executive function, I always use neurodiversity now instead of, you know, ADHD, because it's non, you know, it's not blaming and it's non-pathologizing and it's actually valuing diversity, and where everybody's brain is different. And so, because there's not one ADHD brain, it's just misleading. And, you know, yeah, eventually I like to say like a dopamine imbalance or something, and eventually it'd be just like thyroid or, you know, something where, you know, it's not a big deal. You just need to correct the, you know, some work with the imbalances and manage your lifestyle, like with any chronic, you know, condition. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of the word ADHD.
Yeah, that's a question I'll save for later. But yeah, I ask everybody in my podcast because it was so problematic, and I think really keeps a lot of women from pursuing a diagnosis or at least researching what exactly it is, because it's such a confusing acronym.
I know I've been answering some of your questions as we go.
That's fine. We this is the beauty of an ADHD podcast. It's all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
You were just something about neurodiversity.
Yeah.
And
asked me, well, in your questions, like, what do I prefer to call it? So that's why I answered that.
Well, yeah. So if you could rename it today, what would you do? Would you call it?
Well, I'd always just describe it as women with neuro, you know, I describe it more, you know, women with executive function problems. Now that could be due to many different things, but I mean, I think it more captures the actual struggle. You know, I don't think it's important to label everything specifically, you know, because with ADHD, it's a syndrome and it's chronic. It's not constant. It's variable depending on where your environment is. So sometimes you'll be focusing great. Sometimes you'll do things even better than other people. So it's just a broad base, broad brush kind of approach. And it's why it's difficult for women now. And it's become like a joke line. ADHD is not, it's not taken very seriously. It's become, you know, just stereotypical, and it doesn't help women understand that, you know, that they have something they're coping with that isn't what you traditionally think of as ADHD. Prevents them from getting diagnosed, even though that's, you know, improved a lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was really surprising to me when I was diagnosed, because I wanted to shout it from the rooftops, as many women, I think, when they are diagnosed, realize, you know, this is such a revelation. And the general reaction when I said I was diagnosed with ADHD was, oh, I'm so sorry, as though I had said I was diagnosed answer, with a terminal right. illness. Right?
Well, yeah, no, and that's why I say other. It becomes something that you like. You excise like a, you know, like a mole or like a cancer or something. Like that's how it is thought of. You know, and it's, you know, great that you had that impulse to tell people, because most older women are in the old days, whatever, you know, most women were hiding that, like, and so because of the reaction that often people have from the media or from just other stereotypes that ADHD is this crippling, terrible thing. And it's just who you are. I mean, it's how your brain functions. You know, as you see things in a fresh perspective, it causes some crazy things in your life, but it also makes, you know, other things possible that other people wouldn't, you know, pursue.
When I was diagnosed with ADHD, it completely turned my world upside down. I looked back at so much of my life, my grades in school, my multiple careers and hobbies, my friendships, my marriage, motherhood, my relationship with food and my body, like all of this with a new lens, and it was overwhelming to say the least. If you've been diagnosed with ADHD and you're feeling blown away by this new insight into your brain and how it operates, I totally understand. I can help you begin to sort through this chaos, explore who you are and how your brain operates, so you can finally start to lean into your strengths and begin to use them to your advantage moving forward. Together, we can work to identify what obstacles you've been facing and create strategies to help you start living a more fulfilling, gratifying life. Head over to womeninadhd.com/coaching to book a 30-minute initial consult with me, so we can figure out if my brand of one-on-one coaching is right for you. Again, that's womeninadhd.com/coaching, and you can find that link in the episode show notes.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
So now, since the pandemic, there has been quite an increase in ADHD diagnoses and also all across, you know, in ASD diagnoses and self-diagnoses. So we've got the rise of TikTok and social media and just this, you know, these relatable memes that I think a lot of people are seeing, having a lot more time to scroll through social media, seeing themselves in these videos, in these memes, feeling like, oh my goodness, like I feel seen in a way that I have never felt seen before. And you know, so I feel like there's been this incredible rise in diagnoses, but then at the same time, there's also been this rise in the backlash of like, oh, it's just trendy. Oh, it's probably not ADHD. It's probably something else, you know, seek a medical diagnosis, which I think you should. But, yeah. You know, I think that there's sort of hand in hand with this increase has been this backlash, like, oh, everybody doesn't have ADHD. That's not possible. It's got to be something else, right?
That's been there since the beginning, though. That kind of backlash has been there from the beginning, though. And it just takes different forms, and it wasn't on social media yet. But yeah, nobody believed that that ADD was real at all, you know, and nobody... So there's always been backlash of conservative groups. I remember Scientology had a big thing about it, you know, and Ritalin was a big deal. And, you know, when I first went to get medication, you know, the pharmacist wouldn't tell me at all what kind of medication they had because they thought we were casing the joint, you know, that we're all drug addicts. And, you know, it was very shame-based from the beginning. So there's always been a backlash. I think that a pandemic, yeah, I think just being on Zoom now and being able to seek mental health treatment much more easily has helped. And I think that a lot of women, you know, they just were forced to stop. They were overwhelmed, like you were saying, by kids and everything right in front of them and all these pulls on their attention. But there was also more easily access to information and to connection. But I think it also maybe was a tipping point for a lot of women, like, okay, they sort of were holding it together. And then, phew, then they were able to see, well, okay, I can't escape this anymore. This is what happens in, you know, real time, in real life. And so I think that just became much more prominent, as well as more evident, as well as this rise in connectivity from internationally and just the whole field exploding. You know, I wrote this book in 95, nobody ever heard of it, basically women with ADHD. And so it's just been dramatic. And, you know, Europe was always behind us. And now, you know, internationally, everybody is understanding this now. So just the volumes of people and ways to connect have grown so much.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's much more than 10% of the population?
Women?
Yeah.
What? Women
or do you think it's much more than, you know, you hear that number around 10% of the population.
Well, then that is more. I haven't heard 10% because it was more like 5% when I was coming up. So
maybe I'm rounding up.
You could be right. I just haven't been so connected to what they're saying now. At first they thought that, you know, women were just a very teeny percent though, you know, and so then it got equal. And, so I don't know the latest estimates, but I'd be interested if you find that somewhere.
You know? Yeah, maybe I'm just thinking about, you know, when I explain ADHD to my children, I have a daughter who's in high school, and then I have a son who is in fifth grade. And so, you know, once I was diagnosed, of course, I've been looking at everything they do with a fine tooth comb and everything my parents did. And, and so I, you know, explain it to them, like being left-handed, you know, where I say, you know, imagine my daughter's left-handed and that's about 10% of the population is left-handed. So I'm always like, you know, imagine if when I was a kid, and actually when I was a kid, I'm old enough that my kindergarten teacher forced me to become right-handed.
Right.
And so I was originally left-handed. I was forced to become right-handed. And then when I looked back at my report cards after my diagnosis, it was just like criticism about how my handwriting was terrible and and how messy it was and how I had to focus on being neater. And I was like, I was like, come on, guys. but I was saying, you know, like imagine not having scissors that were for lefties. And then everybody said, why can't you cut, you know, or not having a left-handed desk. And so that seemed to be like the analogy that works best when I talk to my kids about, you know, the idea of accommodations and how, you know, instead of saying, well, I guess you just can't cut, saying, what do you need to be great at cutting? And I think that was something that a big shift for me, just in terms of, you know, I was also in the gifted program growing up. And so my parents always would talk to me about the fact that, like, you know, you have this really high IQ, but your grades are terrible. And they wanted me to feel good about myself. And so they would say things like, well, not everybody can get good grades. It's fine. You don't have to go to university. You don't have, you know, you have street smarts instead of book smarts, they used to say, right? And I, you know, I think they were meaning well, but now looking back, I realize what a blow that was to my sense of self.
Right. And making it impossible for you to really get an accurate view of who you are and what your actual abilities were. And so I was saying it's so important to be able to see that whole picture, not just say, oh, you're smart or no, you're not capable, but to be able to say, and, you know, yes, and is a really important concept, that these are all both true and everything can be, many things can be true at the same time. And so I think that's when, like you said, when you're smart, well, for girls, that's why they don't get diagnosed. They're not stereotypical. If they're smart and they have a structure around their house or at school, or they have support, or they're compensating or internalizing and being overworking, perfectionistic, you know, it's very hard for people to get an accurate picture of them. They're people pleasers often. They're not bothering. They're not hyperactive, acting out little boys. And then often, you know, eventually they become depressed or anxious when they're women. And then that's seen and treated or not. But often that's secondary to the ADHD. And when that's understood and treated, then the depression, anxiety often, you know, are much better or go away. Imagine coping with all this stuff without knowing it. Of course, you're going to be depressed and anxious. But at some point, women or girls, they don't hit a wall usually till later if they are smart and inattentive. But when they go to college sometimes, or even, you know, after college, when they get married or have careers or children, at some point they're not able to manage like other people maybe they were able to be like earlier. And then they hit a wall and then they don't know why, what just hit, you know, even though it's been they've been controlling it or compensating it their whole life, at some point they hit a wall and then they get diagnosed if they're lucky.
Yeah, you know, I'm the youngest and only had older brothers, but I'm amazed at how many women I have interviewed so far who had siblings who were diagnosed with ADHD and showed more stereotypical, you know, hyperactivity, disruptive traits. And they were labeled as like the good kid, right? So they were the ones who the parents were grateful. They're just like, oh, you're easy. You're not a lot of work. Thank you. and they held, you know, and then they sort of developed so much anxiety. And like you said, that people pleasing and like the pressure to be the good kid who held it all together. And then, you know, at some point all exploded.
Right. Like, now I don't want to, you know, it's my job not to bother, you know, my parents are already had their hands full. They say, yeah, that's very common. And so they just keep it inside and the boy gets treated and everybody understands what's going on. And there just takes many more years for anybody to understand. They just get lost or hide. And nobody understands the difficulty that they're dealing with. Well, that's mm-hmm. a pretty common thing for girls. And then women, I mean, their biggest coping mechanism is often hiding, even once they're diagnosed. Sounds like you and maybe your generation, you know, and the women you talk to are more out there once they get diagnosed and they know what's going on or they're on medication, that they're not as, even if they have some embarrassment or shame, it sounds like you guys are more forthcoming with like, this is, you know, this is like real and this is what I need, and you know, like advocacy for yourself. Instead of hiding so much. I don't know, is that what you find?
Yeah, I mean, I think there, I do see a lot of advocacy, I think, when you're diagnosed in adulthood, just because we have so much empathy for, you know, like I feel like if I can save one woman from going through what I went through in terms of a misdiagnosis, and just, you know, always feeling like, you know, I've been diagnosed with depression and anxiety. I was diagnosed with PPD and PPA, and I was on, you know, various cocktails of medications, and always felt like it wasn't working, but also felt like, well, if it's this bad on the medication, imagine how bad it'll be off the medication. And so, you know, always sort of upping the dose and feeling like, why am I depressed? I have a good life. So there was that confusion too, which was like, where is this depression even coming from? So, you know, just the putting, you know, connecting the dots and putting this puzzle together, it just feels like, yeah, immediately you're like, if I could save somebody who's going through this, it'll be worth it.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, also the, how do you, but willingness to advocate and open to other people about what you need. That's what, you know, for yourself, that's often harder.
Yeah, although I think we do have a gift for just blurting things out and being an open book. I've never really been very good at like keeping things to myself. So I feel like that is an accidental ADHD gift for sure. Good. Which is like, if I could help somebody else by blabbing on and I always used to call myself Sophia from the Golden Girls, where I was like, I don't know if I had a stroke, but like, I just say I have no self-censor. So I've used it to my advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. No, like, so I answered your question about like, what are some of the advantages? And I always say, you know, ADHD saved me from the life of artificiality and superficiality and mediocrity that I wanted. Like, I wanted to conform. I wanted to fit in and I couldn't, you know, I tried and I couldn't. So, and it just kept pushing me to find, and I had to be really, really interested in something. So I had to keep things interesting. I had to keep moving on to find things that were really of value to me and really meaningful. And even though it was much harder for me to write or to organize my thoughts, I had to keep digging deeper until I found some, you know, really pearls at the bottom of my piles kind of, but I had to keep going. And so I couldn't just like, oh, okay. It kept pushing me. And so, that's a good thing about ADHD, that, you know, you're going to want to, you know, find something that's really, you know, compelling for you. Like that's the key actually, to find something compelling to help move you, you know, instead of this discipline as like a berating yourself and punishing yourself, it's like disciple, from the same word as disciple, to follow with love. And, you know, that's the key with ADHD, to find something compelling that draws your attention to move toward, not just a negative kind of, you know, way to control yourself or fix yourself, wait until you're all better kind of, and until women say, oh, I'm going to wait till I'm all organized before I let myself feel entitled to have a life, you know, and like that doesn't work. So, you know, finding something that's really exciting and getting support that you need, because you're going to need support to fill in some of your gaps here with executive functioning and to keep moving towards an exciting future for yourself that's meaningful mm-hmm. to you.
I think that's another thing we talk about a lot that comes up in conversation a lot is how problematic the term superpower can be for many people, because, you know, there is a lot of grief. There is a lot of regret in an adult diagnosis. There is a lot of that, like, what could have been, how did nobody see the signs? You know, how could my life have been different? And so what I love about your approach with the radical acceptance too, is that idea that, like, in, you know, once you see yourself, and you can start to, you know, once you understand what is actually happening, you can start to lean into your strengths and you can start to, you know, see your gifts. And then it's like you do radically transform in terms of who you are. And it, you can kind of look at it as a superpower.
You can appreciate it for so many of the gifts.
Yeah.
But it's also really important to point out, like, you know, it's not like, oh, it's a great gift. You know, it's not just a great gift. It's, you know, you don't want to underestimate or undermine, you know, or non-validate the really high level of difficulty it is to get to that gift. So that's why I said it really has to be all yes. And it can't just be, oh, this is great, because it's difficult. And so you got to really, you know, that's part of the superpower too, to say, okay, well, what do I need to make this, you know, engine go? You know, I need the fuel. I need the support. I can't go on this journey all by myself, kind of. So yeah, to not, you know, if you're getting help, you want somebody who can help you see your gifts and your strengths and help you move toward that. But you don't want to underestimate, you know, the difficulty level.
Oh, I love that.
I'd like to take a moment to thank BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know I am a big proponent of therapy. Therapy provides me the best opportunity for verbal processing, something that is so important for my kind of brain and my sense of self. What I love about BetterHelp is that it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional therapy that's done securely online from the comfort of your home. They assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and it's available for clients worldwide. So you get access to a broad range of expertise that might not be available to you locally. It also tends to be more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. If you visit their website and read their testimonials, there are actually quite a few reviews that specifically reference help with ADHD. As a special offer for listeners of the Women and ADHD podcast, you'll get 10% off your first month. Simply sign up at betterhelp.com/womenADHD. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/womenADHD. And there's a link in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.
So yeah, I mean, I guess my last question is, you know, what do you love most about your ADHD?
Oh, well, that's sort of what I said before. Like, I answered the question in advance. I mean, what I have loved about it is, like, it made me have to keep going to find a unique way to live, you know, that I couldn't just settle for an ordinary life, because I couldn't. I tried and I couldn't do it. I couldn't, you know, I graduated college a long time ago. I went home, tried to become a housewife, which is a joke. but I think I would have, you know, like, you know, I was trying to do all that for about like 3 months. You know, I got married and I tried to like play that role and it was like a nightmare. And so I couldn't do that, luckily. And, you know, it was many more years before I understood why. It was very difficult. But it, like I said, it propelled me to keep trying to search. And I would hit a barrier and then I'd go another way. And it made me keep going. I didn't know what else to do. You know, I always said, like, I'm like Monet said, I only do two things well, you know, paint and garden, you know, but sometimes you have very narrow skills, but they're good. And it took me a while to find out exactly where was a good fit for me, you know? And so I think you just have to keep going with ADHD and not settle for something that doesn't fit you, because that won't work. And that's the good thing about ADHD, it just won't work. And so you have to keep going till you find something that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And marry well, like Hollowell says, you know, marry the right person.
oh my goodness, yes. And I think, you know, intuition is something I think that is such a muscle to build when it comes to following your gut and kind of going with, like you said, like what you're compelled to do. And I think, you know, intuition is something that when you have lived your life undiagnosed, you really kind of stop listening to yourself. You're told that you're doing things wrong by your teachers and, you know, by society in so many different ways that I think we tend to lose touch with our intuition. I think that's such an important thing to rebuild as an adult.
Right. and you usually have really good intuition, you know, once it's released, you know, but I think it's mostly also because you're just coping so hard. I mean, it just takes all your energy to, when you're undiagnosed or untreated and you don't know, it's like going through some jungle and you don't really know what's going on or the way out. And so it just takes a tremendous amount of energy. So you just don't even have the luxury of, oh, well, let me stop and see what I want or where I want to go. You just keep going. And so I think that's what happens when you find the right person to help you or the right medication or the right group of people, then you can, you know, sort of see the light and then you can sort of find your way through it with your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Trust well, yourself it's again. Yeah.
Incredible. And for me, this has been such an incredible journey yeah. and I look forward to learning more. Sometimes I feel like the more I learn, the less I know about ADHD. But
that's because it's so limiting in that name. What you're saying is you just, the more you're learning about human beings. I mean, really, yeah. when it comes down to it, these are just, we're all human beings. We all have differences. We all have things we do well, things we are challenged. And so I think the bigger and broader lens as you get in this longer and longer is like, okay, here's a diverse human being like all of us. And what works for you? And what do you need to become more of who you are more easily?
Beautiful. Now with the workbook, the Radical Guide for Women with ADHD, it feels like it's a book club. You know, do women have book clubs around this Radical Guide? Yeah. Do you have an official outline that you offer?
I don't. You know, we thought we would do that right away. But a lot of people just started doing it. So like ADDA, who's the National Association for Adults with Learning with ADD, ADDA, mm-hmm. ADD.org, they have a book club there that someone leads based on our book. A lot of people use it for, I use it in my groups. I don't use it as a strict workbook. I use a lot of the, you know, I pare it down a little bit so to make it more easy to use. But yeah, it can be used in a lot of different ways. And people do use it all over the place. And we never got around to like licensing that or whatever. And I would hope if people use it, you know, have people buy the book. You know? But people are using it. And I think it is a great guide. But because we like it because it's not just about ADHD, it's about you as a woman. And a lot of it's these gender issues for women not claiming space for themselves, not taking a center stage in themselves, not using their voice. And, you know, all women have these issues. And for women with ADHD, it's even more important to claim that space, even though you're still disorganized or struggling. So that's sort of the key. Don't wait until you're over your ADHD. That's my final thought, you know, because I see people in their 70s, 80s, they've waited their whole life, spend 7 hours a day trying to figure out how to cook dinner, you know, or how to do this or do that. And, you know, they waited and now, you know, you don't want to wait because that's not mm-hmm. going to help you, you know, have any extra energy or any more excitement, or it doesn't help stimulate your brain to just focus on everything that you're not good at all day.
Right. Yeah. I feel like I, you know, that's one lesson I need to learn more, which is like, you don't have to be at your wit's end to ask for help. I think that's something that we bring on a lot as women too, that I feel like I have to do all of this by myself until I am literally at my breaking point.
Yeah, no, you don't want to do that. Yeah. Asking for help is a huge issue for women with ADHD and maybe for all women, but for women with ADHD, they feel like that is like a reveal about themselves that they don't want other people to see. And so even with kids, this idea of, you know, fostering interdependence and saying, I'm not very good at this, so I'm good at this. So how about you go do this with your aunt and I'll do this for them. And just, you know, how can we all help each other? And we all can value diversity and we all have difficulties. We all struggle. So moms don't have to hide this terrible secret from their kids. And they always say, I don't want the kids to be like me. But, you know, if they do have same, you know, traits or tendencies, you don't want them to feel like you're saying something shaming or about them either. So you say, yeah, this is what I do to help myself. This is how I value differences and difficulties. And so we're all in this together, kind of, you know, would be the ideal.
That's beautiful. Well, like I said, I feel like with every diagnosis, your book should be the prescription required reading.
Well, the therapists have used it for many years. I mean, that's sort of what helped get it like launch. And I do want to, you know, put a plug for my other book too, which is sort of lost in the shuffle a lot, Journeys Through Adulthood, mm-hmm. which I've just got the rights back to now. And I've just put out on audio tape. So I'm promoting that now because it's hard to find in the hardcover, in the print cover now, but it's just been put out in audio. And so that's a great book. I wrote that in the middle there about, it's for men and women and mental health professionals about, you know, what happens after you understand your brain, then what about that search for meaning and identity? And then what happens when you get successful? What's that crisis of success about? Then how do you control things, you know, that double-edged sword about, okay, now I'm doing well, but now I'm just creating more things to, you know, control. And so that's a really good book too. So those three books, I think they're all on audio and on Kindle.
Awesome. Yeah. I almost exclusively listen to my books, but that's good to know. So I will put a link to that in the episode notes as well.
Yeah, good. Oh, and okay. Well, you'll tell me later when this is going to be out there, but,
this is going to be airing on December 6th, which is my official 1-year anniversary of the podcast.
Well, so
this
an honor. Thank you. I'm glad to be part of that.
Oh, are you kidding? The honor is mine. This is such a treat. And I feel like such a wonderful, you know, celebration for me for this journey to be able to pick your brain and have you. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. And
I know, it's really
talking
fun.
About
it's
this.
Like amazing that it's just been a year. I mean, you obviously look like you're just owning the whole field here. I mean, like you learned so much and you've helped so many people even in 1 year. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. I'm like, this is hyper-focus at its best, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Katie.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And there you have it. Thank you for listening, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Women and ADHD podcast. Also, you know we ADHDers crave feedback, and I would really appreciate hearing from you, the listener. If you're a fan of the podcast, please take a moment to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Audible. And if that feels like too much, and I get it, then just take a few seconds right now to give me a 5-star rating. Or share this episode on your own social media to help reach more women who maybe have yet to discover and lean into this gift of neurodivergency. And they may still be struggling and don't even know why. And if you'd like to find out more about me and my one-on-one coaching for women with ADHD, head over to womenandadhd.com/coaching. And you can always find that link in the show notes. I'll see you next week when I interview another amazing woman who discovered that she is not lazy or crazy or broken, but she has ADHD, and she is now on the path to understanding her neurodiversity and finally using this gift to her advantage. Take care till then.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.